The world entirely is at war.
Troops waiting for the zero hour.
This is D-Day.
They got one.
Veterans Chronicles. For the next hour, join host Gene Pell and an honored roster of heroic soldiers, sailors, and fighting aviators, recalling and retelling their personal stories from World War II...
A state of war!
...to the present day.
Allied Air Forces began an attack on military targets in Iraq and Kuwait.
Now the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network present Veterans Chronicles with your host, Gene Pell.
Welcome to this week's edition of Veterans Chronicles. I'm Gene Pell. My guest this week is Walter Ehlers, a veteran of World War II who participated in the invasion of North Africa, the landings at Sicily, and was on Omaha Beach on D-Day. 3 days after that June 6, 1944 landing, Ehlers would earn the nation's highest award for valor, the Medal of Honor. His chronicle begins in Kansas, amidst depression and drought.
I was born and raised on a farm. And, of course, Kansas has four seasons and things like that. And our farm was a farm that was you know, self-supporting. We did everything. We raised cattle, hogs, chickens, and ducks and geese. And we planted acreage. And we raised our own grain to feed them and things like that. The biggest farm we had was about 400 acres. The smallest one had was about 160 acres. My dad bought that one and bought it in 29, lost it in 33 because the bank went closed and he couldn't make his payments, couldn't get his money out of the bank, so the bank foreclosed on him. You know, that's the craziest thing I've ever heard, but that's exactly what happened in 33. Those were tough times, and I grew up during the drought. And we had the longest drought, and then we had one of the biggest floods we ever had in Kansas after that in 1953, I think it was, no, 19, excuse me, it was 1935, I think it was. The next one was in the 50s, so the big one, but they used to have quite a few floods there, but that time, and we were living close to Fort Riley. And we went down on the reservation and the highway 77 comes off of a hill there. And we went down there to see the flood. And the water was from hill to hill. And you could see clear across to the hills on the other side. It was 13 miles and there was solid water all through there. It was unbelievable.
I know you had a brother, Roland.
I had two brothers. My brother Klaus is still living. And he spent 3 years in the Pacific and fought, and most of the time he was there, and he was with the 24th Infantry Division. That was MacArthur's own, and he put him in a heck of a lot of combat. And my brother and I, we enlisted in 1940, my oldest brother, Roland. We enlisted in 1940 for the 7th, for the third, the 7th Division, and we went into the 17th Infantry Regiment of that division, and we were at Fort Ord, California, when they decided that, they decided the 3rd Division wanted regular soldiers, and the 7th Division was going to start training selective service, so they kept a cadre of non-coms and so forth, and sent all the privates, first class, all the regular Army guys, they sent them off to the 3rd Infantry Division. So we ended up with the 30th Infantry Regiment of the 3rd Division in San Francisco at the Presidio, which was one of the nicest places ever to serve. The food was great. It was just like banquet every breakfast for breakfast, every morning for breakfast. And then the 3rd Infantry Division had to call their regiments together up for training in Fort Lewis, Washington. And on 1 year after I got into the service, we went home for a 30-day leave, and we came back to the outfit in Fort Lewis, and And we got a weekend pass, went up on the Mount Rainier, and we was going to go skiing. When they announced on the radio that Pearl Harbor was bombed and that everybody had to return immediately to their units. And so we took off our skis, and when I looked down that mountain, I figured that was the first day of my life that was saved by the war. Because I had no idea how I was going to get down that mountain. You know, in Kansas, we're lucky to have a 200-foot hill.
Right.
Yeah. So, but that was how I got started. And then we had all of our amphibious training and all that kind of stuff, and khaki uniforms. And we even trained down at Camp Pendleton. I came back to Fort Ord, and they loaded us onto a train. We thought we were going to go to the Pacific because we were in khaki uniforms. And they sent us clear across the states to Camp Pickett, Virginia, which was a hellhole of all installations. And the mud, you walk around that clay mud, it would pile up on your overshoes like you look like you had snowshoes on with all that snow around, with all that black or red mud around on your feet. But we worked through that, and then we got new equipment. We got brand new rifles and all that kind of stuff, and they were in Cosmoline. We had to clean those. We were a dirty mess, so we had to have all changes of clothes. And in late October 1942, they put us on a ship, and we were out sailing in the Atlantic, and they gave us French translation books. And, of course, being kind of naive, you know, not knowing much about countries, we figured that, well, we were going to France, but we didn't know there was another country that spoke French.
Right.
So as we got close to Africa, where they told us that we were going to invade at Fadela, and it's a little city north of Casablanca, and that was where the 3rd Infantry Division landed in World War II, and that was their first time in Africa, too. And then I was at the Casablanca Conference when President Roosevelt was there, and General Eisenhower and de Gaulle and Patton, and I don't know who else, but all these people were there. And President's coming down, and we got to be the honor guard, and we're standing down the street on both sides of the street, and the President's coming down in his Jeep, and he's smoking an old cigar, and he's looking around, and he says, "These are mighty fine-looking troops that make good replacements for the 1st Infantry Division." Well, 2 weeks later, we were in the 1st Infantry Division. We were regular Army, and so they went all they wanted to send up all regular Army up there. I don't know why, but anyway, we went. My brother and I went together.
Well, you got back to the 3rd Division eventually, but you're sort of unique in that you participated in 3 invasions.
Yeah, well,
North Africa, Sicily, and Omaha.
Yeah. And then I landed in Africa, and I landed July the 10th in Sicily, and then I landed in Normandy. And we in England, we were separated, and that was because of the Sullivan brother incident. And so General Marshall wanted the brothers separated, and so they separated me. The company commander called us in and says, "I got 3 things to tell you." He says, "Number one is that you don't have enough insurance. You only have 5,000 with the maximum is 10,000. That was a lot of insurance in those days. But when you were on $21 a month to start with, well, you didn't have much money for insurance.
Yeah.
So that's what we had. But we increased our insurance. And then he said the next thing is because of the Sullivan brother incident, that's why General Marshall ordered brothers to be separated, because we're going to go into another big action conflict here. And they might have, as much as 50% casualties. We didn't think they should have that many, but anyway. He said, "I'm going to send Walt to L Company," and that was a sister company in the same battalion and the same regiment and everything. and we were in the 18th Infantry Regiment, the 1st Division. That's what we joined in Africa, and that's where we stayed until we got to England. And, well, and I stayed in the 18th with L Company, with my brother stayed in K Company, and I was transferred to L Company, and then I had all new soldiers to train before I got into combat, just which was going to be June the 6th, you know. Got that done.
What was the invasion of Sicily like?
The invasion of Sicily, it wasn't too complicated because we landed, and actually it wasn't much of a beach. It was mostly rocks. You climb out of these. Now, the Higgins boats in those days, the one that we had, was a rounded one. You know, it was just called an assault boat, and you had to jump over the sides. Mm-hmm. And if you land in the water, well, we got in close to the rocks, and we got on the rocks and got up into the town. The Germans weren't shooting at us, after we got into town, we found lots of mines, and they mined doors, they mined dead people, and they mined the grape yards. We didn't dare pick grapes because we had a guy had his hand blown off in the grape yard trying to pick a grape. And then they had these Bouncing Betty mines. They planted along the roads and the trails, and they have three prongs on them. And they put them down in the ground, and they throw some leaves over it. And that's all that covers them. And you don't see them unless you spot the wire sticking out or something like that. And we've done that. We've seen them. But a lot of guys got wounded from mines.
We're talking this week with Medal of Honor recipient Walter Ehlers about his World War II experiences. And we'll continue the conversation after these messages.
Veterans Chronicles is now available wherever you are.
Through your MP3 player.
Log on to www.radioamerica.org
and click on the podcasting icon.
Look for Veterans Chronicles. Then follow the information on your screen to subscribe to our podcast.
You can also find the Veterans Chronicles podcast on Apple iTunes.
The Veterans Chronicles podcast.
Now online
at radioamerica.org.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network.
Welcome back to Veterans Chronicles. I'm Gene Pell, visiting this week with World War II veteran Walter Ehlers, a recipient of the Medal of Honor for actions during the Allied invasion of Normandy in 1944. Before D-Day, he had fought in North Africa and in Sicily, where he was witness to a major Allied tragedy.
We were up in the hills on the first day, and we witnessed the greatest tragedy that happened. It was the Germans had bombed the Navy in the port down there, and we got the word out in the field that the paratroopers were coming over in C-47 planes and not to shoot at them when they came. And so after that bomb raid, why, here comes these planes, and somebody in the Navy didn't get the word, and they started firing. And, of course, naturally, when one starts firing, they all start firing. They shot down 17 planes, paratroop planes, before they could get them stopped from firing on them. We had paratroopers land amongst us up there in the battlefield. The Germans at that time were also making a counterattack with their tanks, which was mainly on the next day. And so we had Navy shooting point blank at the German tanks coming in down the valley there, and they kind of repelled them. We started fighting the Germans up through Sicily. We had a lot of firefights and things like that. But it was...
Were you aware of
rugged terrain?
Sorry, were you or your comrades aware of the rivalry that existed between Patton and Montgomery in those days, and did it affect you at all?
Yes, we were. Fact is, we knew that Patton was heading the armored around to the left, and Montgomery's coming around on the right, and they were supposed to meet at what was it, Messina or
Messina?
The name of the town starts with a P.
we'll find that.
Anyway, I had a chance to talk to General Eisenhower after he retired from the university after he was president, and he was down in Indian Wells, California, and my wife went to take our two kids and go over and meet him, and so she called the secretary and they said, yeah, he'd give us 20 minutes, and so we went out to Palm Springs and down to the Indian Wells, and we went in there to the ranch, and General Eisenhower came out to talk to us. And instead of 20 minutes, we talked for about 2 hours.
Wow.
And he was telling me about all of his generals, and he told me about Patton. And I thought Patton was a very good soldier, but there's a lot of guys that didn't. And I heard his speech, you know, when he gave that speech in Sicily at the... We were a bunch of the troops that were around that. And he didn't cuss like they did it in the movies. The movie was really exaggerated beyond... I felt ashamed that we even watched the movie. You know, I thought they were... I felt that way about some of the Vietnam movies, too, right? Like the 4th of July and some of those in the platoon. And they were exaggerating there, too. But anyway, I thought, and Ike told me that Patton had a great ego, but he was the best general he had when it come to giving him a job to do. He got it done, mm-hmm. and that was what was important. Mm-hmm. And he said he had to do a lot of tactical maneuvers to keep him on because everybody was trying to get his head.
Well, that part of the movie was accurate.
Yeah, yeah.
They were after him, all right, but sometimes with good reason as well.
I didn't want to lose him.
No.
I used him for the breakthrough, you know, Normandy. Yeah.
And he made the breakthrough.
And Patton asked for the 1st Division to lead the to be with him when they made the breakthrough, so
right.
He wanted to make sure that it was going to work. So he had called on the 1st Division, and he got them.
So when you finished with your Sicilian campaign, where did you go then?
We went to England.
To England for more training for D-Day.
We had a lot of amphibious training, cross-country hiking, and map reading, and compass reading, and things like that. We didn't have these modern stuff.
Did you have any idea then where the next big blow was going to take place?
They told us it was going to be on the Normandy coast. That's all. We didn't know anything about it. They never even showed us the maps or anything. I was given a map, but it was a map of France, and it was a cloth map, and it was all the stuff was in French on it, and I had that sewn in my uniform and a little old round compass, and my job with the company was we were supposed to be in the second wave, and my job was to take in my squad into the city of Trivieres for reconnaissance, you know, and needless to say, we didn't get there.
We'll be back with Walter Ayler's account of the action that merited him the Medal of Honor after these messages.
Chronicles is presented by the American Veteran Center, an educational foundation dedicated toward preserving the legacy of America's servicemen and servicewomen of all generations. The center is home to two organizations, the World War II Veterans Committee and the National Vietnam Veterans Committee, each working to tell the stories of their respective veterans. In addition to this program, the American Veterans Center is also the primary sponsor of the National Memorial Day Parade, held annually in Washington, D.C. For more information on the American Veterans Center and its programs, visit the center's website at www.americanveteranscenter.org or call 703-302-1012, 703-302-1012.
Heavy fighting is still raging.
3,639 wounded.
Red light, green light, and out, out. Get out.
Gentlemen, this is the real thing.
The brutal death march of batons.
Germany calling. Germany calling.
Right in the purest pace.
We'll have the ammunition and we'll all
cheer for Harlem on parade.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network. Once again, Gene Pell.
Welcome back to Veterans Chronicles. I'm Gene Pell. On June 6, 1944, D-Day, Walter Ehlers landed on Omaha Beach as part of the 3rd Infantry Division. 3 days later, he would lead an attack against German positions that would earn him the Medal of Honor. Here is his account of what happened.
It just was utter chaos on the beach there. And so there was a beach master on the beach, and I asked him, what direction do we go from here? And he said, well, you take that path there. It says if you go to right or left of it, you'll be stepping on mines, because nothing had been cleared yet except for the path, which was cleared by GIs who'd already stepped on the mines, and they were all going a single file up in there. And they got, most of them, I guess, got killed or wounded. And my squad, when we got up there, the last row of wire hadn't been blown yet. So there were two Bangalore torpedo men there, and I asked them if they would blow the wire for us. They said, we can't. We're pinned down by a sniper. I said, where's the sniper firing from? So he kind of general gives the direction he thought it was, and I said, well, there's not much we can do, but we'll lay down a field of fire if you blow the wire for us. So we did that, and he got up to blow the wire, the two guys, and they were getting they got the torpedo together, and they put it under, they were getting ready to shove it under the wire. The one guy got killed right there. I don't know what happened to the other one, but he got the torpedo lit, and it blew the wire. And as soon as the wire was blown, of course, we left. You know, we had to go through it. Mm-hmm. And we ran up, and on the other side, apparently there was no mines, and we went straight up the hill, and we got into the trenches. There were trenches from pillbox to pillbox up there on the hills there, you know, like where the cemetery is up there, Gold Hill Cemetery. Well, there were trenches along the cliffs there, you know, and we started chasing the Germans, and we were going to our right. And because there was a pillbox up there, and we saw two of the men had satchel charges were killed, and we saw another guy coming up with a satchel charge, and he got killed too. But we went around behind it, and we captured 4 Germans, and we sent them down because they wanted Germans for interrogation. And then we kept on going, and what we didn't kill, they escaped from us by going through the trenches, you know, and getting out of there, because they knew where they were going. We didn't know where we were going, but we would fall in the trench. And I have to go, retract here a little bit. The first thing that really stunned me was when I got it on the beach, and after I got the beach masters told me to follow that path, I heard them say, come on, 16, let's go. And then I heard somebody else say, which 16? You see, the 16th Infantry Regiment of the 1st Division was the first wave for the 1st Division, and the 116th was the first wave for the 29th Infantry Division. And so both 16s were landed right next to one another, and it was on easy red, and I knew I was in trouble then because I didn't know what 16 they were talking about. So I just kept, my squad just kept on going. So we were out there all by ourselves. And next day when I saw the company commander, he said, "We didn't know where you guys were. They didn't have any idea. We were already up there when they landed."
Right.
And but not my company commander, but it was the first lieutenant who became the company commander automatically because the company commander got killed on D-Day at the same time. And I don't know what time he got killed, but my brother got killed on D-Day too, on the ramp coming down on a K Company's boat. Our company commander, our company commander got killed on D-Day. It's not my brother's company commander.
How long before you were able to move further inland?
Pardon?
How long before you were able to start moving inland forward?
Well, we started right away. From, you know, we were going in, and we got to the hedgerow. We couldn't go much further because we had all this fighting to do.
Right.
And so we were waiting for the rest of the troops to catch up with us. And so when they started moving in up in there, right, of course, the Germans started retreating more. And we were fighting them all the way because they were fighting defensive actions to keep them from running over them. And on the 7th of June, on the night of the 7th, we had a perimeter out with we were probably in about maybe a quarter of a mile. I don't know. We was be out a couple of hedgerows inland anyway. And we were bedded down at night there, right in the kind of like a ditch along the hedgerow there off of the field. And this German patrol came in, and the outpost shot at them, but then they couldn't shoot at them when they got inside the perimeter. And we couldn't shoot at them because we'd been shooting our own troops. So they ran right over us, and lo and behold, the company commander wanted a squad to go out, and so the sergeant came down and informed us that I had to take a squad out and follow this patrol. Well, it was at night, and it was dark. And if you get down, and if you get out of that field, you get out there in the road, it's even pitch dark there, and the only thing you can see is the sky above you.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were following them by sound, and we came across a briefcase that they had dropped, and so we picked it up, carried it a little ways further. And I told the guys, I said, we don't know where the heck we're going, and we don't know where they've gone, because they got out of our sounding distance. And so we took the case and went back and gave it to company commander. He took it to battalion. They opened it up, and it had the second and third lines of defense in it, you know, where they were going to retreat to. And
really?
From these defense positions, they had these fields of the on these hedgerows in front of them. They had them all zeroed in for their weapons, mortars and things like that, and artillery in the background. And on the 8th of June, we were still fighting out there and getting across. We finally got in. On the 9th of the June, I got my squad had to lead our company. Then there was another squad in another our platoon, rather, to lead our platoon. And then our first platoon was over in the field beyond us, and they had a squad going out, and they got fired upon there. And so I told the guys, I said, "We got to get out of this field. We'd get pinned down out there. We'd never get anywhere." So I rushed them up to the hedgerow in front of us. I didn't know whether there was any Germans behind or not, but they apparently weren't. But then I went down the hedgerow because I heard this machine gun firing, and I started up the other hedgerow, and I got up on the hedgerow there, and I heard this clonking back there, and I came abreast of four German soldiers, and they all had their guns pointed at me, and the machine gun was still firing up there. I had no choice but to shoot them, because if I hadn't shot them, they'd have killed me. And I shot them before they had a chance to react. And we got up there, and we got the I came up on the machine gun, and it came out from back of the hedgerow there. And they didn't even know I was there. They thought that shooting down there was their own men shooting, I guess, because they couldn't tell. And knocked out that machine gun nest, and then we started up the hedgerow again, and there was a machine gun out there, and it started firing. And so I kept going up the hedgerow. And I got on to this one. By the way, I had my men fix their bayonets because these guys were from here, that wall over there from me when I was confronted, when I confronted them with that. And I had my rifle at port arms, so I just, started shooting like that, pointing at their bellies. It worked. And so I had the guys fix their bayonets because we were too close, and you fire out 8 rounds and you got to reload. So I came up on the knoll there, and I had the bayonet fixed on my rifle. And these Germans saw the bayonet, and their eyes got big, and there was two mortar positions there. They're the size of our 80-millimeter mortars. You know, they're the heavy mortars. And there's about 12 men in there. And when they saw me with my bayonet, and then my squad coming up behind me, they took off. And, of course, we had to shoot them. So we killed quite a few of them there. And then we went on up, and we encountered another German in the hedgerow up there. And this guy was running down towards us, and the guys were shooting him. And he just kept coming, and we thought he was going to run over us because he hadn't started to fall or anything. And so all of a sudden, he just went flat down on his face like that. But he was running so hard he was still functioning when he was being hit.
Well, tell me about the incident for which you were given the Medal of Honor.
Well, that's part of it.
Okay.
That's the first day. I got it for the 9th and 10th of June.
9th and 10th.
And then on the 10th of June, I got the job again to take my squad in the lead. And so we're going up. This time I'm not out in the middle of the field. I'm out along the side of a hedgerow. I didn't want to be in the middle of a field. And so that if somebody starts shooting us, they get one side or the other of the hedgerow or something like this. But we started getting fire from the right and from the left. They're shooting across the hedgerow because they could see our heads when we were going along there. And then the hedgerows in front of us had Germans. So we had them on all three sides. Company commander told us to pass up the word for us to withdraw. And I knew that if we turned around and withdrew, they'd shoot us all. So I went up on the little mound there, and so I started firing in a semicircle and as fast as I could. But there, I had to keep loading. So my automatic rifleman, he came up, and he was firing. And so we fired when the squad got back to the other hedgerow and behind it and so forth where the company was. Then we turned to go back, and I saw him putting a machine gun down in the corner there, and there was 3 men putting in a machine gun. And so I was busy firing on them when I got hit in the back, and it spun me around, and I was falling down as I spun around. And I saw a German in the hedgerow. I shot him, and I got up. It hit me here in the rib. I got up and saw my BAR man lying on the field, so I went up there, and he'd been hit in the leg, and he couldn't walk, and had hit in the right arm, and he couldn't carry his rifle, so I picked him up and got his arm around my shoulder and carried him back to the hedgerow behind me. Turning over to the medics, then I went back and got the rifle and came back with it. That was under fire, too, but they didn't hit me. And so when I got back, while they were loading my automatic rifleman onto the ambulance, it had brought up an ambulance. And I told the company commander, I said, well, you better have the medics look at my back, and I think I need a patch. And so he turned me around, and he sees this bullet hole that comes out my trench shovel in the back. He says, my God, you've been shot clear through. You should be dead. I said, not hardly. But anyway, they took off my pack, and they saw what happened. The bullet hit my rib, and it glanced, I guess, a bit and went into my pack, hit a bar of soap that was in my pack, and it turned the bar of soap and it went right through the edge of my mother's picture and right through the middle of the trench shovel. It looked like I'd been shot clear through.
A remarkable story from a remarkable hero. Medal of Honor recipient, Walter Ehlers. On the next Veterans Chronicles, retired Army Lieutenant General Hal Moore, a 1945 graduate of West Point, a recipient of the Distinguished Service Cross, and the co-author with Joe Galloway of the acclaimed book We Were Soldiers Once and Young. That was later made into a feature movie, starring Mel Gibson as then Lieutenant Colonel Moore.
I think Mel did a great job, and we became good friends in over the year or two. The movie was about 75% accurate as compared to the book. The part of the movie that my wife and I really objected to was the part where she was shown personally delivering telegrams of men who were killed in action to the families. Now, my wife didn't do that. When this battle hit, the telegrams started coming, delivered by cab drivers. And my wife found out what was going on, and, you know, she didn't know if the next telegram was going to come to her door.
Retired Army Lieutenant General Hal Moore, that's coming up on the next Veterans Chronicles. When we return, another story of World War II and a salute to another American military hero. This is Veterans Chronicles on the Radio America Network.
This is Tim Holbert from the American Veterans Center inviting you to join us for our upcoming 12th annual conference, November 12th through the 14th in Washington, D.C. The conference is your opportunity to meet some of America's greatest military heroes from World War II through Iraq and Afghanistan, hearing their stories of valor firsthand. Confirmed participants include General David Petraeus, commander of CENTCOM, Air Force Colonel and retired astronaut Buzz Aldrin, several of the Band of Brothers from World War II, Baseball Hall of Famer and World War II vet Bob Feller, Dutch Van Kirk, navigator of the Enola Gay, recipients of the Medal of Honor, veterans portrayed in the film Black Hawk Down, decorated heroes from today's military, and much, much more. Conference attendees are also invited to exclusive receptions, including one honoring our wounded warriors currently recovering at Walter Reed Army Medical Center. To request a full schedule or registration form, visit our website at www.AmericanVeteransCenter.org. Call 703-302-1012, extension 220, or email avc@AmericanVeteransCenter.org. That's avc@AmericanVeteransCenter.org. Spend Veterans Day weekend in the company of heroes.